south of Louisville, Kentucky. On I-65, I pulled into a rest stop before I pushed on through the night. I met a deadhead with a backpack, and man, I knew that guy. He asked, if you're heading south, well, I could really use the ride.
Hi, this is Carl Weinchek with the Daily Music Break. The Daily Music Break covers all music, regardless of era or genre. We can be found at www.dailymusicbreak.com. Please check out the great music and sign up for some free email newsletters. Today, we're thrilled to be speaking with a country singer-songwriter by the name of Dan Weber. Dan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you, Carl?
Just fine. Thanks very, very much for taking time out. You know, it's a real pleasure for us to have a chance to chat with you. Dan, to start with, can you let the folks know where they can find your music? I'm going to ask you at the end, too, but maybe the folks want to jot it down now as well.
It's www.danwebermusic.com, and that's Weber with one B. Like the grill in your backyard, as it were. And gosh, I'm all over the internet. I think if you just type in Dan Weber and music, you will find a plethora of things on my website, YouTube, you know, all the Bandcamp, SoundCloud, Spotify, etc. I'm everywhere.
Great. You've been everywhere, huh?
I'm trying.
And Dan, you know, there's a question I like to ask either by example of who influenced you or in your own words. How would you describe the music that you write and that you play?
I think I'm right in the wheelhouse of what they call Americana, which is they're story songs in essence. But it's singer songwriter story songs. It's a little bit country. It's a little bit folk. It's a little bit bluegrass. Americana is a pretty big tent, but right. I think that's probably the best description, based on, you know, all the hundred subgenres that are out there anymore.
Right.
And you know, influences. I think there's a lot of them. I've been influenced by a lot of Texas singer songwriters. Folks like Towns Van Zandt and Guy Clark. But I mean, going back to high school, I think my biggest influence of all was, I heard Casey Jones by the Grateful Dead and I was just hooked. It's a story song. It's a song about trains. I grew up loving Johnny Cash and my mom had, Live at Folsom Prison and I just loved that. And so I loved train songs. I loved story songs and that. And then listening to the Grateful Dead was interesting because that turned me on to Jerry Garcia had a bluegrass side with David Grisman and a band called Olden in the Way, and it turned me on to Peter Rowan, and that sort of turned me on to bluegrass and a lot of those guys and going backwards. And then they also turned me on to country music because they covered Hank Williams, Merle Haggard, Buck Owens, Marty Robbins. So in some ways, the Grateful Dead was my sort of gateway drug into folk music, into bluegrass, and into country. Right. They were sort of an amalgam of all those things.
Right. It's one bleeds into the other or transitions into the other. And I guess Vassar Clemens is in there as well. I guess you can't talk about it without mentioning him. I'm just amazed at some of the things that he did. So that's quite a rich vein you tapped into.
Well, it's true of a lot of people. I mean, if you hear like someone like Clapton talks about, you know, the blues or whatever, eventually you get back to like Robert Johnson. And when you talk about country and things like that, eventually you get back to, in Texas, you get back to, say, Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys, or, you know, if you keep going back, and in country, a lot of times you go straight through to Hank Williams down to Jimmy Rogers, and you're, but But most people have that experience where they like something contemporary and then they realize, oh, that was influenced by. So, and we're all sort of influenced by it. I think that's kind of the cool thing about music. There's that continuum, you know.
We're going to get back to you in a second, but it reminds me of a great clip on YouTube of Louis Armstrong being on the Johnny Cash show and talking about Louis Armstrong having a session actually with Jimmy Rogers.
Yeah,
a white guy and a black guy before that was, you know, really accepted. And playing I forget the name of the song, it's a well-known song, it'll come to me in the middle of the night. But the point is that it's all connected, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty interesting. Like, there's a great old Jimmy Rogers record with him, where the Carter family comes over. And it's very Amos and Andy. He's like, Mother Maybelle, get me a chicken. And so, and she says, yes, Jimmy, I'll get you a chicken. And then like 5 seconds later on the record, like he's eating fried chicken. It's hokey and it's sexist and it's whatever, but it all sort of goes back there. I mean, if you follow all this stuff, eventually you end up somewhere in Alabama or Mississippi or somewhere down in there. It's interesting. And of course, bluegrass, you know, came out of the mountains, but a lot of that came from, you know, Scottish traditions and that kind of thing.
Right.
And that's influenced heavily in the, I mean, that's how a lot of those German and Scotch immigrants in Texas, the same way, where you got Bob Wills and then all that was influenced by the culture of, you know, of black folks and where they brought their traditions with them. So it's, I mean, American music's interesting that way. I think it all sort of goes back to, for me anyways, it's all about people telling stories in that tradition of being able to pass something down, because that's how people kept history before they, you know, had Wikipedia.
The good old days. But I you know, you and I could probably talk about this.
Yeah, it's a tangent, right. We might want to keep the tangents out of the interview. Right,
right. And this podcast is actually about Dan Weber, so we're going to get back.
Oh, right. Yeah, we're not just talking about music. Well, it's all right.
You started in music, according to the information you were kind enough to send, a little bit later than a lot of other folks. Could you describe what happened, how you got in, and what that was like, Dan?
I was pretty late. I got a guitar probably when I was 30, and I was a park ranger in Canyonlands National Park. Maybe I was 27, 28, but I got a guitar, but I didn't play it for several years. I just didn't know how. I didn't even know what I was doing with it, really. And I lugged it through life with me through several moves, and then a friend taught me how to play, and then I played it once a month for probably 7, 8, 10 years. And I was on a train in Mexico in 2006, and it was a musical train. It was a train with musicians on it who were, and we were the patrons, the people on the train. We listened to people play music through while the train was going through Mexico. And one of those artists, oddly enough, was Peter Rowan. And,
really?
Yeah, and it's a fascinating, it's called Roots on the Rails. You really should check them out. If you go to like flyingunderradar.com or Roots on the Rails, you'll find them. And they do these musical train trips all across America with guys like Dave Elvin and Tom Russell. It's just amazing artists that they have. And so I was on this thing, and there was some sort of open mic thing, and I'd been playing guitar a little bit and written a song or two. So I got up in front of people on this gyrating train where the mic kept trying to hit you in the head because it was bouncing so badly on the Mexican rails. And I played in front of those people, and people came up to me and said, hey, you're really good at that. That was your first time? That's crazy. And I was hooked, and I just wanted to write songs at that point. And so I just dove headlong into it. And then in 2008, I played my first real open mic in front of people. So I got a late start because I was 40 when I did it. So.
Right. Well, that's very interesting. That's a I've never heard a story like that. That's pretty cool.
And yeah, you, Mexico. Yeah.
You must have been thinking about it somewhat because you said you had written a couple of songs. So it must have been something that was running around in the back of your head to some extent.
Yeah. I think. Well, I've been a fan of all these great songwriters for so long, and I've always been somewhat of a writer. I mean, I love to write in journals, and I always loved to write, but I just never found something like the right out. Like I probably like 20 years ago, I would have been a blogger, except right. Blogging hadn't been invented yet. So I didn't. So I started writing songs, and I knew three chords, and I still know three chords, and
right.
And then it just sort of took off. Like I met so many great people locally here in the Portland, Oregon music scene, and I met all these great people, and the people started asking me to play shows, and I would play shows, and then one thing led to another, and there were some local contests, and I entered those, and I started winning the contests or coming in second or third, and thought, well, that's crazy, because I just felt like I was so new to the whole songwriting thing.
Right.
And then I started to submit my songs nationally to contests, and I started getting in those, and getting honorable mentions in second places and third places, and getting invited to play in places like Texas and Oklahoma and Connecticut and, you know, Arizona. And so I started just hopping on planes and going and playing festivals and making fans. And eventually I made my first record, Ash and Bone, and on my new record, What I'm Looking For, should be out here in February, March, something like that. So it's snowballed.
Well, that's quite a success story. That's terrific that it had.
Yeah,
like it happened organically. It's a different story than someone who decides when they're quite young that they're going to be a musician, which is a great thing and an honorable thing, of course. But it's all you did it. You kind of did it backwards. What did you do before?
I was a park ranger for a while down in Utah, and then I worked for a temporary agency hiring nurses for hospitals. And then I got an apprenticeship as a real estate appraiser. And I still do that to a certain extent when I'm not traveling around playing music. I still appraise houses. So it's, I measure the outside of the house. I get soaking wet in the rain. I step in a lot of dog crap and walk into a lot of spider webs. But other than that, it's delightful. I drive around and I meet interesting people. It's a good right brain, left brain mix. And really? Like everyone else, I think in music, most people have another job to try and keep the home fires burning, as it were, and the mortgage paid.
It's funny because I just interviewed a gentleman who's a musician like you, and he had a young child, so he couldn't travel around the country. So he got a PhD in fish hatchery population analysis.
Sure. Analysis. Yeah. So, right.
Yeah, so I knew he was both a better musician than me and a lot smarter than me. So I was trying to figure out where I fit into the conversation.
I seem like I do everything backwards, because most of my friends who are, full-time musicians or were,
right.
did that until they hit 38 and then said, oh God, I had a kid. Now I want to have a mortgage. I want to buy a house. I got to get a job and then stayed in music, but got some other job. And I didn't know I was supposed to be doing the music thing. So I went out and got a job like a normal person, and then came into the music thing late. And now it's my passion. Now I'm just trying to figure out how to be a full-time musician and ditch the job. But so far, no luck. But
you got to write a sitcom about it. It sounds like the makings of a sitcom.
A sitcom. That's great. Yeah, that's what the world needs is another
another sitcom.
Another sitcom. Yeah.
Now, the you obviously, looking at your YouTube clips, you tell a lot of stories, and then you start singing and you tell a lot of stories. You tell stories before you sing, then you tell stories once you start singing the songs themselves. How does that you come up with a story you want to tell and then you put it to music? What is the process like for you, Dan?
Well, the songs come first. I mean, they're independent of each other, really. That in some ways the songs come organically from wherever songs come from. I mean, they sort of come from the sky. The doorbell rings and someone just standing at the door and hands you something to sign, and you were trying to think of a song, and all of a sudden that's how it's. Songs are wherever the muse taps you on the shoulder, you go with it, and that's. But the stories in between the songs are usually like personal stories about something that's happened in my life recently or something that's happened in my life in the past that, I've always sort of been a storyteller, and so I've just found a way to say, that story reminds me of this song somehow. So I kind of try and weave those, and sometimes the story is about what inspired the song, and sometimes they're just completely random asides kind of thing.
Right.
I think, in some ways, I think what makes me unique, I mean, there's other storytellers out there. I mean, guys like Ramblin' Jack and Arlo Guthrie and folks who tell tons and tons of stories. But I think for me, it's sort of like a conversation with the audience, because I play a lot of house concerts in smaller venues like that where people will start telling their story in the middle of my show. And as long as people are entertained, I'm fine with it. It's,
right.
That's really what you're there for. It's not to, I don't want to be a bummer all the time.
Right. No, I'm sure you're not. I listened to your story about Comcast and I was,
yeah. Oh yeah, sure. That's, if you've got them, that thing is epic. It's so funny that I got the same guy twice in 2 days running. And it just, and when the guy said that, he said, well, I'd do a crazy, go for it. I'd do it crazy all day. And I thought, wow, that is a song hook for somebody. I walked around. And so that was a story like that organically spurred that idea. But then I didn't know how to write I Deal With Crazy All Day. I mean, I thought, wow, that's a good song hook. I mean, Toby Keith should write that.
Right.
It's funny. But I couldn't figure out how to write it. So I walked around for 6 months thinking, I deal with crazy. Gosh, I don't want to ruin it. And then I got pulled over by this cop, and I thought, well, that kind of fits. Some of these things take time, and some of them
we've got to percolate.
Yeah, and some of them take like 40 minutes. And I think for me, anyways, and I think other people are like this, some other songwriters, the best ones are the ones that come. And an hour later, you're done with the song, and you can't believe you just wrote that because 5 minutes before you started writing this, you didn't have a single idea of what to do, and the thing came to you, and you went down whatever path it wanted to tell you to go down, and when you were done with it, you stood back and went, wow, I just did that. I mean, it's kind of this, for me, it's sort of like being a guy who does, like, pole vaulting, except I'd never have pole vaulted in my life, and now I just pole vaulted over something 15 feet high that I didn't even know I could do it. And then you did it, and then you look at it and think, I couldn't do that again if I tried. And you try and try and try, and then lightning strikes again, and it's songwriting's like, it's a weird mystery. It's a very interesting thing. There's
something deep in the unconscious with songwriting.
I think a lot of it. I think that's true of a lot of art.
I forget whether it was Illinois Jacquet or Coleman Hawkins. It's very different, obviously, but we talk about everything being connected. And he wrote Back Home Again in Indiana, which is a jazz classic. And he wrote it because he was afraid of flying, and he had to take a plane, and he started whistling nervously, and that turned out to be the harmony of the song.
Yeah. Yeah, they come from it, that's the thing. But I think the other part of songwriting, which is also a part of writing in general, whether you're writing for whatever it is, there's a discipline side to it too.
Right.
That you can't just wait for the once every 6 months for it to tap you on the shoulder. I mean, you can, but it's not likely to tap you on the shoulder unless you have your guitar in your hand or a piece of paper and a pen. And so you have to sort of court the muse by picking up the guitar, having the pen at the ready, and being willing to let it find you, I guess. And there's a discipline. Yeah, right. You've got to.
Yeah, but you can't. You know. It's sorry to interrupt you, but you can't mess around if you're trying to. You know, if you have an album you're trying to do, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think it's so funny because I will write a song and think, "Wow, that's a you know." And once in a while, you write one and you think, "Wow, that's a good song." And you will literally go the next 3 months thinking you may never write a good song again. And it's sort of it's terrifying because you actually think I may never, you know, it's right. Like pole vaulting. You just don't think you can do it. You don't even know how you did it the last time.
Right.
And now you can sit there and try and try and try. And I have found that if I keep writing songs, if I keep at it and I write and I write and I write and I could write like 7 or 8 bad songs in a row and think, God, I'm never going to write a good one again. And then like the next day, like poof, there will be the good one when you least expect it. So I think there's some magic to being open to it and sitting down and doing it. And eventually after 3 years goes by, you think, oh, I've got like 35 songs or something like that for this last record that I've written in the last 3 years. And that's about one a month. And you think, well, okay. And then you start to whittle them down into which are the ones you're going to put on the record. And I think for this one, I've got 14. So that's
okay. That's a good one.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
So that leads to the next question is bring it full circle. What is ahead? Are you touring, playing a lot of house concerts, playing more formalized. I know house concerts are formal, but in clubs, what are you doing, and when will the album be out?
I have some shows in Dallas and Houston and in Oklahoma, Norman, Oklahoma, in February on Valentine's Day weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also playing at a... I'm in a song contest in the South Florida Folk Festival in Fort Lauderdale in January. And then I'm trying to book my summer tour as we speak. So that's still up in the air. And a lot of that will be house concerts and festivals and occasionally venues. I try and stay out of bars as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I try and be in as many listening environments as possible. And typically bars are not. People aren't there to listen.
They're being in a bar.
Yeah, exactly. And your background music, and well, I mean, I can do that at home.
Yes.
And house concerts are just magic. I mean, if you've never been to one and somebody has one, go, because it's one of those things when you see a house concert and you connect with the artist on that level in that intimate setting, you suddenly. Usually one of two things happens. One, you think, God, how can I do this in my living room? Or you never want to go see anybody in a 17,000 seat hockey arena again. You just can't fathom how impersonal that is and how disconnected it feels. It's really kind of a life-changing thing. And so that in a combination, hopefully, you know, this is that time of year you start hearing back from festivals as far as summer festivals and where you can play. And so I'll try and feather some of those in there as well. And the record will be out. It's pretty much done, but we're working on artwork and the website revamp. So I think February, March, my official CD release in Portland is March 21st and 22nd, first day of spring. and I'm doing two live shows in Portland that will be recorded for a live CD. So we'll
yeah.
have the. So I will be telling the stories for the live CD. And,
well, I'm sure they're going to be entertaining ones, just like the others.
Yeah, that'll be fun. It'll be good to. A lot of people say, "God, I love your records; they're great." But I really wish you had a live CD because I think some people are better in record, and some people are better live. And I think I'm just better. I mean, I think I personally sound better on a record. Like, you know, my guitar sounds better, my voice sounds better. I don't screw up the lyrics or anything. But live is so different because I'm so much more animated, and it's such a different experience to just be in that moment, and you can capture that live, where it's really hard to get that in the studio.
Absolutely. Dan, please tell us again where folks can find your music.
www.danwebermusic.com. That's Weber with one B. And you could find me, you could find my records on CD Baby and iTunes and all that good stuff. And you can also find me on Bandcamp and SoundCloud and Reverb Nation and Spotify and pretty much and if there's music out there, if you just type in Dan Weber music, there are several other Dan Webers, and if they're really impressive, that's me. There's actually this great like guitar player Dan Weber out there somewhere. And that guy's like 10 times a guitar player I am, and I love it when people think that I'm him, but it's not me. So that's what I meant by that. If you see someone who's a guitar wizard, yeah, that's definitely.
That's you.
That's really not. No, it's but and I think YouTube has quite a few videos,
right.
And you know, nowadays people just they take videos of you when you're playing, and
right.
you see it all the time from the stage. You just have no idea where those end up. So
mm-hmm.
there's I've probably said some fairly embarrassing things in public that are.
I saw Ringo play. He travels with his band, and he stopped the show and told someone to stop filming, you know, videoing. It was actually, it's kind of, you think of Ringo as this warm and fuzzy guy, which I'm sure he is most of the time.
Yeah.
He was quite like, you turn that off right now, I'm not playing.
Yeah, I think there's some artists who really feel that way. We live in interesting times, you know, I was reading today in the latest New Yorker, which came out yesterday, about there's this whole viral thing where kids are making 6-second videos.
Right.
And on this thing called Vine. And
right.
and these kids have like 42 million followers on like Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, and literally it's them doing things for 6 seconds at a time and being watched so many times that these kids are making like $200,000 a year making 6-second videos. So you have that extreme, and then you have this sort of older demographic that says, oh, I don't want anyone to video me. And my generation is sort of stuck right in the middle.
fighting over your generation. That's amazing. Yeah, I've heard of that 6-second deal. We're
right in the middle of this idea of there's this Facebook thing where everyone's living their lives vicariously online. And then there's the generation ahead of us that, you know, sort of thinks that, well, I don't need Facebook, or I don't need, you know, they didn't even want computers, you know, and I feel like I'm sandwiched right in the middle. I wasn't a digital kid, but I'm not from that other generation that has no computer literacy.
Right.
I mean, so it's funny being in that weird middle ground and wondering how much of that you really want to participate in. Like,
mm-hmm.
I'm on Facebook. You can go to Facebook and find my music page there as well, and that has access to everything else, but I'm not on Twitter because I don't really think the world wants to know what I think in 140 characters or less.
Right, or what you had for lunch, or, you know, yeah.
That's right, which was grape nuts and yogurt, so that was...
Dan, it's been absolutely a pleasure. I really appreciate you taking time out, and we will see you and keep up with you and speak to you again.
All right. I look forward to it.
Okay. Thanks, man.
Thanks, Carl. He said, I know you won't believe me. That's all right. I just wanted someone to talk with tonight. He said, I know you don't believe in me. That's all right. I just wanted someone to talk with tonight.